Stephen will be reading and signing books at Powell's on Burnside tonight at 7:30. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. Many thanks to Stephen for visiting us at KBOO, and to all of you for listening.
Well, evil, evil, nobody can be.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Mulugeta Sarah Commemorative Conference, Tuesday, November 13th, from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the University Place Hotel and Conference Center in Portland. This half-day conference honors Mulugeta Sarah, 28-year-old Ethiopian college student living in Portland who was murdered by racist skinheads on November 13th, 1988. This conference will include panel discussions, continuing legal education for attorneys, and community training on addressing hate. Again, that's the Mulugeta Sarah Commemorative Conference, Tuesday, November 13th, from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the University Place Hotel and Conference Center, 310 Southwest Lincoln Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts scene. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and I'm joined in the studio today by two trailblazers of the independent comics scene. Ezra Clayton Daniels is here. Ezra is the author of the sci-fi graphic novel Upgrade Soul, which began life as an immersive online project. He's also the creator of Loaded Blanks Greetings, a line of fill-in-the-blanks greetings cards by comics artists, and the instigator of the comic art battle, which he's brought to comics gatherings throughout the country. Ezra, great to have you here.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Also joining us is Ben Passmore. Ben is the creator of the surreal comic series, Dayglow A-Hole, and the collection Your Black Friend and Other Strangers. And Ben and Ezra have also definitely dabbled in the area of animation. So Ezra and Ben, great to have you on Words and Pictures.
Thank you.
Yep.
So yeah, I do want to find out more about your individual projects, but let's jump right in to this new book that you've been collaborating on. It's called Bottom Feeders, but it doesn't have the vowels in it.
Nope.
We've been told it's an aggressively non-commercial title.
All the kids drop the vowels.
Right.
That's what the kids are into.
Well, it's set in a gentrifying neighborhood of Chicago and in a place that could be both familiar and alien to readers. Ezra, you're credited as the writer on this project, and Ben, you're tackling the art. How did the two of you get together on this project, and like, how much crossover is there between the writing and the drawing?
Well, we met in Chicago at CAKE, the Chicago Alternative Comics Expo, in 2014, I think.
Yeah, in a bathroom.
In a bathroom. Which, I don't know why you always say that.
It's so funny.
It's such a funny joke. But no, so we met just like on the floor of the convention, and Ben gave me a copy of his book, Dayglow A-Hole. We never met before, and he gave me his book, and I was just like, this book is like at such a like level of just like, it just inspired such awe in me from this like kid that I'd never seen before, never heard of before, that I was just like, this guy's going to be a household name within our lifetime. So I was just like, I got to grab his coattails and try to harness this power before it gets too big for me. So I had the opportunity to contribute to a sci-fi romance anthology called Speculative Relationships. That's done by Tyrell Cannon and Scott Kroll out of Chicago.
Big ups.
And I had an idea for a story, and I asked Ben if he wanted to collaborate on it with me. And I don't know if I was clear about this when I approached you for that one, but it was kind of like a dry run in my mind for working on a larger project together.
Mm-hmm.
So we did that. It went really well. I had also, at the same time, been polishing off this horror sci-fi comedy script called Bottom Feeders. And after we did the story together, I was like, Ben, do you want to collaborate on a longer thing? He said, yeah. So I basically just sent him a script that I'd written in screenplay format, because that's how I write stuff. And I sent him the script, and it wasn't paginated for comics or anything. It was just a film script, and I just let him run with it.
Mm-hmm.
And the back and forth was pretty minimal, so it was like a pretty seamless collaboration.
Yeah. I had worked for like, you know, mostly off the internet for people that wanted to maybe break into comics, you know, like dentists with like more money than skill.
I think we've all been there.
Yeah. It was, whatever. Shout out to random dentists. But this is the first time that I had worked for someone who was genuinely really talented. And also Ezra is just an amazing draftsperson. So it was initially, you know, like pretty intimidating to tackle the comic, but I mean, it's an amazing story. And, you know, I think initially I had recognized Ezra from doing readings for, was it Brain Frame in Chicago? And I checked out his book, his comic Changers, which he disavows now. But I think we were both just like, oh man, this dude looks just like me. So there were so many points of interest. And the process ended up being very, very seamless. Ezra's definitely got a good combination of being an amazing writer and also just very open-minded about how a collaborative piece can take shape. I am a tyrant and could never do that, what Ezra does or did with me.
It's a good match because I'm also very non-confrontational.
Right.
Well, you're both writers and artists, and you definitely have your own projects that you do solo. And you're also both really into sci-fi and surrealism, and you work those into your regular comics. Well, Ezra in particular, I remember reading that you're a big fan of David Cronenberg, the Canadian director of classic body horror films like Scanners and
absolutely.
Dead Ringers, The Fly. What elements of the story in Bottom Feeders would you consider Cronenbergian?
Well, basically the whole thing. Cronenberg is a huge influence. I also cite Tremors as a big influence. Tonally, it's really in line with Tremors. When we pitch it around to people, we kind of describe it as Get Out meets Tremors. That's kind of the vibe we're going for. It's like Tremors with like a heavy dose of political and racial commentary.
Yeah, Get Out, the Jordan Peele film, because, right. Upgrade Soul, I was noticing when I saw Get Out that there were also these body switching scenes that reminded me of Upgrade Soul. Yeah. Which came earlier.
Oh, yeah, totally. So they totally ripped me off.
No, print that.
A lot of these things are, you know, part of the universal consciousness, I'm sure, that we're all drawing from the same inspirations and channeling them in similar ways.
Right.
So when I say surrealism is in both of your works, I'm thinking of like that original kind of century-old surrealism in the wake of World War I, where there was just enough weirdness and dreamlike horror to kind of offset the normality at the core of things. And a lot of surrealism nowadays, it's just like, oh, here's a weird image that we're throwing in. But no, I mean, this stuff was really... The early surrealism was really meant to kind of shake you to the core. There had been this brutality in the world, and it had invaded people's dreams.
Yeah. I mean, to me, like, surrealism is a form, like, the form of surrealism is interesting to me. I mean, for me, if we were going to go for, like, a deep cut, I'm more of, like a post-war German Dadaist, you know? Both because, you know, surrealism, its aesthetics didn't necessarily, like, go against fascism. You know what I mean? Dali was not, he was a pro-fascist. You know what I mean? But there was not a single Dadaist that messed with the Nazis. You know what I mean?
Yes, Dali was cool with Francisco Franco in Spain.
Yeah. But the Dadaists were really into absurdity and idiosyncratic moments, like interruptions. And I think that there is, like... something that I visually, if I can pat my own back, but like something that I think is cool visually about Bottom Feeders is that it's a combination of these like heavy cinematic, like gross moments, but also there's a lot of long shots, which was totally Ezra. I don't do that normally. I'm all up in your face, but Ezra really had this, like, his vision was to have a lot of these like really pulled out moments so we feel like contained in this space the whole time, and it slows down the pacing to me of the comic, and that feels like very like Ingmar Bergman or something. And then those things are interrupted with what I feel is very Dadaist, these like interruptions of like violence or comedy, and I think you're not really sure what you're gonna get, because it's like you're hit with both sort of simultaneously.
Without giving away too many spoilers, what can you tell us about Bottom Feeders? Give us kind of an intro into the characters and the setting.
Yeah, well, the story is about this young woman named Darla, who is an aspiring fashion designer, and she moves to a neighborhood on the south side of Chicago, which I have called the Bottom Yards, which is named after a neighborhood, an actual neighborhood called Back of the Yards in Chicago. But it's a blighted, semi-industrial, semi-gentrifying neighborhood that's on the very, very early stages of gentrification. So she moves here in search of cheap rent, and she moves into a building that has a long storied history of creepiness and mythology in the neighborhood, not knowing what the building was created for.
It's a big old brutalist building, huh?
Yeah. Exactly. With no windows, just like these weird spires on the top. And she moves into the building and over a short period of time learns what the building was originally intended for and gets thrown into a body horror nightmare of epic proportions.
Yeah. Yeah. Good blurb. Solid blurb.
So, yeah, obviously you guys are both, you're both very politically minded. You're both historically minded. What kind of elements did you want to bring into this story to like give people some material to chew on?
Yeah, well, I think from a writing perspective, my goal with the story was to kind of chew through some ideas and concepts that I've been not obsessed with, but just occupied by. And I wanted to do it in a way that kind of candy-coated these issues so that I could work my way through them and express them and share my ideas and opinions about these things with other people in a way that was more palatable than just having a straightforward conversation about these things. And in the process, just kind of like therapeutically working through my feelings about that. So that's where I was coming from the writing perspective.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely, I have my own approach to sort of dealing with quote unquote political themes, sociopolitical themes, but definitely like in working in this book, I've felt like using sort of genre to address contemporary problems does seem like, I don't know, just very, very great. because I think people will approach to something like a genre horror story feeling like they're going to recognize it immediately, and the subversion ends up being the message. And I mean, there's a lot of sci-fi and horror that there's like a long tradition of that. I remember we watched the Candyman movie, mm-hmm. and there's this big chunk of Candyman where they're talking about gentrification in Chicago that I did not remember.
Right.
But it's in there. It's a long conversation. For me, just in terms of an aspect of the visuals, when we originally talked about the book, we were going to do a black and white, and we ended up doing a limited palette. And for me, I think something that I thought about was the, like, when you go, like, people that gentrify neighborhoods go in not recognizing that the space isn't necessarily constructed for them. You know, like a lot of these places where peripheral communities live, they're sort of figuring out how to thrive in an environment that's constructed to suck money out of them, you know what I mean? Not for their survival specifically. So I used a lot of like, you know, fluorescent pinks, like sort of candy colors that contrasted this like very depressing building to sort of illustrate that in like the back of your mind that the space is very, hopefully very attractive because my color schemes are great. But but also the building is very, very uninhabitable. Like I tried Ezra designed the outside, and in the inside I tried to continue the same sort of brutalist vibe where everything's poured concrete. There's like no obvious place to put furniture. Like the layouts of these apartments are ridiculous. And so hopefully you're thinking like, who would try to live in this space?
Ezra, last year a couple of years ago at the Long Beach Comics Expo, you won the Dwayne McDuffie Award for Diversity in Comics. Mm-hmm. Dwayne McDuffie was a trailblazing writer who did work for both comics and television. What can you tell us about his legacy? He wasn't that old a guy either.
Yeah, it was such a tragic loss, but his work was really influential in a lot of ways. I mean, his stuff was so prolific that he kind of touched everybody who was into geek culture in the 90s in some way, whether they knew it or not. I came up with my little brother watching Static Shock on TV, the cartoon, and yeah, we watched that because it was one of the only representations of like a hero of color on TV, so we really gravitated toward that. And so that was, you know, always a big influence for me. So when I saw that the Dwayne McDuffie Award Foundation had an open call for submissions for the award, I had just finished Upgrade Soul, so I submitted a PDF before I'd even checked it for typos. It was just like, it was in a rough state, but I finished the whole thing. I sent it off, and then shockingly, I was named to the finalists. There was, I think, five finalists, and I was named to the finalists. And so I went to Long Beach Comic Con because I just moved to LA at that time, and it wasn't that hard to get to. Certainly not expecting to win, but just like excited to have been a part of this thing because, like I said, the legacy was so important, and I'd never been really nominated for anything like that before. So I went, and I was the only person who was nominated that showed up, which would have made it really awkward if I didn't win. But thankfully and gratefully, I did win it. And yeah, it was like a really terrifically moving experience. Also partly because the ceremony was officiated by Phil LaMarr, who was the voice of Static Shock and the voice of like every great cartoon character ever. So yeah, I got to meet him, and yeah, it was really super amazing.
Well, Upgrade Soul is collected now as a graphic novel, but it started out, it was serialized. It was appearing on mobile platforms. There were animation elements. How did it develop? You've exhibited it all over Europe at animation festivals there.
Yeah, so I launched, Upgrade Soul was originally launched in collaboration with a developer named Eric Lawyer as an interactive iOS app in 2012. And we put it out at a time when there wasn't a lot of stuff being done like that. So by virtue of it being novel, we became part of the kind of global conversation about the history of or the future of comics and the future of storytelling. So the app came out, it was pretty successful when it launched. We had like 40,000 downloads in the first couple weeks, and it got into a lot of hands. And so we were invited to Europe a few times to lecture about comics, and it you know, got a little bit of a foothold there. But you know, these things are expensive, and it was kind of the Wild West, and the App Store was like still trying to find its footing. So we kind of ran out of money about halfway through. So we updated about half of the story, and then we put it on hold. And then after we put it on hold, Apple updated their iOS and stopped supporting older apps. And so it doesn't even run on current devices anymore. You have to have an old iPhone to see it. But we still stand by it, and we're working on updating it. So part of the launch of the new book that we're trying to piggyback on is to find funding to relaunch the app. So hopefully we're going to have that hopefully by next summer, in conjunction with we're doing a vinyl release of the soundtrack that was done by Alexis Gideon for the app. So we're putting that on vinyl on a record label called FPE out of Chicago. And so we're going to hopefully time all this stuff together next summer.
Well, give us a little taste of the story to Upgrade Soul in case people want to pick up the graphic novel.
Yeah, yeah. So Upgrade Soul is a story about an elderly couple who go through an experimental rejuvenation procedure. And little do they know that the procedure utilizes cloning technology, and they're inadvertently cloned. And their clones are vastly superior intellectually and physically. So they're way smarter, they're way healthier, they'll live twice as long as the originals. But because of the way they look, which is severely disfigured, they'll be subject to a lot of limitations in just living a life in the world. So the whole story is about, it's really all about identity, and which is a truer vessel for the individual's identity. Is it the one that looks like the person that we recognize, or the one that by all statistical measures is a superior version, but because of the way they look, they won't be able to move through the world with the same ease. So it touches on racism, sexism, ableism, and kind of the conflicts of all these things.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and we're talking today about the new sci-fi graphic novel, Bottom Feeders, with author Ezra Clayton Daniels and artist Ben Passmore. Ben, you tend to draw yourself as this really nerdy character with the thick glasses, riding a bike around, and
right.
You seem like a very approachable persona in your comics.
yeah, as opposed to in real life. Well, I mean, I used to wear glasses all the time, and I broke them in a car accident, and just haven't, I'm just incredibly lazy, so I just like haven't gotten around to getting new ones. But yeah, I mean, you know, there's like a desire for continuity. Everyone says that I draw myself like 10 years older and like 15 pounds heavier, which I think the alternative would be worse for my personality. I think it's probably better for me if I like, if my homunculus is older and fatter than I am.
But that's part of the long history in independent comics of representing oneself as, you know, unflatteringly as possible.
For sure. It's interesting because I feel like me and Ezra have talked about sort of the privilege to be able to be self-deprecating and how... So, you know, indie comics is still super, super white. It's not as white as it used to be. And there is this long history of a particularly male cartoonist depicting themselves as being gross and overweight and unlovable. And for the black community, I think a lot of times some of the historical inaccessibility of indie comics is that I think it's visceral. I don't think it's necessarily even conscious where they're like, no, you don't. You don't get down on yourself. You have to pump yourself up because you have to do this insane amount. There's so much force that you have to push through the atmosphere of white supremacy to get any kind of notice. So for me, when I started out, I was really conscious of that. That I was like, I'm supposed to really be gassing myself up, but I feel really bad about myself.
Yeah.
And so this presentation has always been very political for me, but also while knowing that that will go maybe unrecognized by the majority of white readers of my comic.
Well, your other book is Your Black Friend and Other Strangers. Right. And this project of yours, it started life as like a zine, like a Xeroxed black and white copied zine. And you were inspired by Black Skin, White Masks, the book by Frantz Fanon. You're a big fan of Frantz Fanon, the author and philosopher from Martinique, the French colony. Yeah, and tell us how this project developed.
Well, a student definitely means that I understand a large percentage of his writing, and I definitely don't. He's an incredibly intelligent person. It's interesting. I think that the spirit in which he, or like in the sort of the foreword of Black Skin, White Mask, he writes about how he's just writing about the specific and African context, and you know what it is like for an African inside sort of the walls of French colonialism, what it's like for them to go to France. And he's essentially talking about code switching, but it's like, you know, it's decades before that term is in use. And for me, when I wrote Your Black Friend, I was writing about what it was like for me and my friend Greg, Greg Jean, who's a writer, to like some black punks in a very white punk scene in New Orleans. And calling it Your Black Friend was sort of tongue-in-cheek on a bunch of levels. One, sort of referring to this tendency that definitely white punks in our scene, and I think sort of the white community at large, has a tendency with black people to make us a representation of all black people. Also that there was a lot of white punks in New Orleans that thought that me and Greg were their friends more because they were motivated to have black friends than have be friends with us in particular. So it was a playing on a whole bunch of assumptions. And, me and Greg, we read Black Skin, White Masks together. And we had these sort of conversations about our experience with race, both blackness being black punks in the South, which for a lot of, you know, more, I would say, normie black people in the South, like, it's a super weird thing to do. It means you like white people, you want to be white. We were both from the Northeast originally. We don't talk like we're from New Orleans. People would say that we talked white. So we felt very marginalized in these two communities that the opposing communities thought that we were totally ingrained in. And I don't know. We were talking about all these things, and then sort of on top of that, I had this realization, specifically when it came to white people, that there was a lot of like geography moved around them and they didn't realize it. Like I lived in a black neighborhood. Like if you saw a white person in that neighborhood, you'd be like, oh, I'm going to give them directions back to the highway because they're not here on purpose. Like no white person was ever there on purpose. So I would go from that black neighborhood into like more downtown New Orleans, and I'd go into like, you know, I go to a corner store, I go to a fish spot, and a white guy would walk into the store of all black people, and the energy would just shift. And I realized white people didn't realize this was happening. And you know, people often call me a pessimist. I think that I'm a little optimistic in that I thought maybe if they had an understanding that, you know, if they peeked into the matrix a little bit, that might help in some way. And I'd spent years sort of like, you know, like with white partners, white friends, you know, I would try to have these sort of like very highly specific conversations about my experience with race. And I was like, you know what? I don't feel like I'm saying anything that James Baldwin or, you know, any black person, any sort of like public black person has said. I think maybe I just need to restate something very, very basic. So your black friend was a troll, but also was an attempt to talk about things that are very, 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 very basic for white people, but also to sort of name some things that I think that black people are sort of ashamed to say out loud because we're not supposed to. I don't feel like we're necessarily supposed to say a lot of this stuff to each other. So I've had, you know, white people say that they really appreciated the book, and that's great. The thing that I feel the most excited about is when another black person walks up to me, particularly like a super weird black kid, and it's like, I feel totally seen by this book. And that is really, really super meaningful to me. And I'm totally blown away by the response. You know, it was a very emotional book for me to make. And I am, you know, happily surprised to see that other people have responded to it very emotionally as well.
Oh, yeah. It won an Ignatz Award, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
And you really pack a lot in there.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. I mean, there's your black friend. It was a zine. I like, you know, I was like broke at the time. I like scammed copies to make this.
That's how everybody did it back
in the day. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Everybody has a friend at Kinko's.
Right. but yeah, now your black friend and other strangers is your black friend, that comic. And then it's a whole mishmash of Nib stuff. You know, all sorts of weird shorts. There's a little bit of Dayglo A-hole in there. And that was just sort of like, get people into like the range of comics that I do, because I like doing the stuff for the Nib, but at the end of the day I like doing weird sci-fi stuff, you know. Hopefully people get into that aspect of my work.
Well, is there anything in the works that you guys would like to talk about?
Dayglo A-hole issue 3 is coming out in the next couple months. I'm late on finishing it, so it's a little delayed, but yeah, next couple months.
And
Of Grey Soul just came out a couple weeks ago. Get that in comic shops. Bottom Feeders comes out June 11th from Fantagraphics Books. And the Of Grey Soul soundtrack comes out sometime next summer. And a bunch of stuff in the pipeline.
Yeah.
And there's thenib.com for some of your comics. And what are your personal websites?
My website's EzraCDaniels.com, and I'm on the social medias at EzraCDaniels.
Yeah, I mean, the regular updates are probably best on Instagram. I'm on Instagram at just Dayglo A-hole, DayGloAhole. Hit me up on Twitter.
Slide into my DMs.
Slide into my DMs. Check out my Amazon wish list.
Well, the book is Bottom Feeders, BTTMFDRS. It's a sci-fi graphic novel from artist Ben Passmore and author Ezra Clayton Daniels. Ben and Ezra, thanks for joining us on Words and Pictures.
Thanks for having us. Yeah.
You've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, SW Conser. Many thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and at KBOO.FM. You can find an archived version of the show later today at KBOO.FM/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at Words and Picture.
KBOO is excited to announce that this Thursday, November 8th, is our big giveaway with Willamette Week Give Guide. When you give $10 or more to KBOO on Thursday, November 8th, you will be entered into a raffle for a $500 gift card to Powell's Bookstore to be used for turning the pages of all the banned books you can't wait to get your fingers on, for those of you 35 and under. This year, Willamette Week and KBOO are challenging our community to give with their dollars and take action by showing up in real life. Authors have been interviewed on our air for over 50 years. Give to KBOO today, and you also get full access to the Chinook Book app, plus freebies from Laughing Planet, Gluten Free Gem, We Press, and Nossa Familia Coffee. You can contribute right now at kboo.fm/give or call at 503-231-8032. Support KBOO, where music makes the movement. Tune in and turn up.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Top Dog Underdog, running Friday, November 9th at the Chapel Theater in Milwaukee. Top Dog Underdog tells the story of a sibling rivalry between African-American brothers in a turbulent relationship punctuated with dark humor. Their names are Lincoln and Booth. This show has adult content and is not recommended for children. Again, that's Top Dog Underdog, running Friday, November 9th at the Chapel Theater, 4107 Southeast Harrison Street in Milwaukee. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.